This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bean Cooley. The 2011 fall TV season has gotten off to a disappointing start, but that's all about to change. Beginning this Sunday, with a new documentary series, the premiere of a new drama series, and the season premiere of another drama series. All three are excellent, invigorating, and exceptionally intelligent. The documentary is the latest PBS multi-part presentation by Ken Burns, a three-night examination of Prohibition, which also is the program's title. Burns and his filmmaking partner, Lynn Novick, aren't just riding the Boardwalk Empire train here. Their story begins a full 100 years before Prohibition began in the 1920s. In fact, they spend the entire first installment explaining how alcohol became a wedge issue and how religious conservatives, women suffragists, and other groups all used it to gain political power. This background is fascinating, not dry, and it touches on many subjects Burns has explored before. Prohibition opens with a quote by Mark Twain, spends the bulk of its time during the Jazz Age, and, in a segment on the anti-alcohol movement of the 1840s, even finds a link to slavery. And in the same segment, narrator Peter Coyote also finds time to reveal the origin of the term teetotaler.
The same reformers who were leading the crusade to abolish slavery saw drinking and the damage it did to individuals, families, and communities as no less sinful, no less corrupting. They called their movement temperance. At first, advocates preached mere moderation. Only ardent spirits like rum and whiskey were off limits. But soon, many began demanding total abstinence from all forms of alcohol, insisting on capital T-total abstinence.
Prohibition is another impressive entry in the Ken Burns canon. And yes, it's another history lesson with almost creepy parallels to today's headlines. These include illegal phone taps, political gamesmanship, and government programs branded as socialism. The three segments of Prohibition are shown Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday nights on PBS, with the opening night bumping right up against Boardwalk Empire on HBO. That's unfortunate. And even more unfortunate is that night one, on Sunday, also bumps up against the sixth-season return of Dexter on Showtime. That series stars Michael C. Hall as a blood spatter expert for the Miami Police Department, who's also a serial killer who tracks and kills other serial killers. It's one of my favorite shows on TV. It's also one that seems to get fans who are not caught up angry whenever I talk about it, even though I'm discussing plot points that happened more than a season before. So this time, I'll stay out of trouble. This time, I'll say only that season 6 begins very strongly and is highly recommended. But even though I won't reveal anything about the shows I've previewed, I will predict the long-time future of this show, just to get it on the record. I believe Dexter ultimately will end the same way I believe AMC's Breaking Bad will end, with the protagonist ultimately uncovered and confronted by a loving relative. In Breaking Bad, I predict it'll be Walter White's DEA brother-in-law, Hank, who closes in on him. In Dexter, it'll be Dexter's own sister, Deborah, who's a cop in the same Miami Police Department. Both of those characters have strong investigative instincts and even stronger stubborn streaks. So both shows, I'm guessing, are on the same narrative path. One new show premiering Sunday following Dexter on Showtime has a narrative path all its own, one I've never seen before in a weekly TV series, and that's saying something. It's called Homeland and stars Claire Danes as Carrie Matheson, a CIA agent who becomes obsessed with Sergeant Nick Brody, an American POW located and rescued after years of brutal captivity in Iraq. Nick, played by Damian Lewis from Band of Brothers and NBC's Life, is about to return home to a hero's welcome. But Carrie, acting on a scrap of vague information, suspects Nick may have been turned while held prisoner and is now a double agent for Al-Qaeda. Carrie takes her suspicions to one of her bosses, played by Mandy Patinkin in a welcome return to TV, but he's not buying it.
You're suggesting that Abenazir planted intelligence on his own safe house? Just so we could recover Sergeant Brody.
I realize it sounds like a reach.
To say the least. Why not just drop him near a checkpoint, make it look like he escaped? Why would you sacrifice 13 trained fighters?
Because Abenazir is playing the long game, and this way no one suspects a thing.
Except you.
Yeah, except me. Yeah. And Sergeant Brody's due home from Germany tomorrow morning, which gives us just under 22 hours.
To do what?
To authorize a surveillance package, to tap his phones, wire his house, follow him wherever he goes.
David will never sign off on that, you know it.
Well, of course he won't. The White House needs a poster boy for the war, and David just served him up on a platter. That's why I'm coming to you.
I'm not going over his head, not on a hunch.
But if I'm right, if he is a terrorist, we need eyes and ears on Brody from the minute he steps off that plane.
Never happened.
If Carrie is right, she's the real hero of this story. If not, Nick's not only the victim, he's the hero, too. For the first few episodes of Homeland, our loyalties are split, and we don't know which character to root for. Only that they're both played by incredibly likable and sympathetic performers. And watching Carrie pursue Brody without being certain of his true motives puts a fascinating new twist on an otherwise familiar tale. Eventually, we will discover the truth, and the series and the drama will continue from there. But for right now, Homeland is offering something unique to television. And when you're talking about television, that's a phrase you don't hear very often. Just in time, thanks to Homeland and Dexter and Prohibition, the 2011 TV season is looking up and looking good. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Up next, Flora Lichtman is here with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
What have you got going for us today?
We are not in your backyard. This is a home tour that, like you've never seen before,
I'm pretty sure.
We go to Long Island, Calverton, Long Island, which is near Riverhead, and visit Kevin Shea, who built himself a geodesic dome to live in. This dome is a home.
A dome home. And he built it out of a kit, is that right?
Yeah, he built it out of a kit. So he's
sent away.
In 1993, he says, he was thumbing through Popular Science magazine, and he gets to the back, and there are these ads in the back, and he sees an ad for a geodesic dome kit.
Right.
And for $11,000, you can build a dome that is 44 feet tall, 70 feet in diameter, and that's like 93,000 cubic feet. It's huge. It's very hard to get a sense of the scale until you actually see him climb the rope that he has going from the floor to the ceiling in the middle of the dome, which you can see on our website.
At Science Friday. Go up to our website for a video pick of the week at sciencefriday.com. His neighbors were not very happy.
His neighbors were not happy. I mean, the best part is we drive in with Kevin down his driveway, and before we turn in, it looks like regular sort of white picket fence suburbia. And then you get to his driveway, and it's this kind of mushroom-shaped, forest green, windowless, from the back anyway, dome. And they were, you know, this house does not belong here, was the vibe from the neighbors.
And he's also made it very energy efficient, right?
I mean, Kevin Shea amazed me. He takes green to another level. So we've got here a solar array, a wind turbine, geothermal system inside. He's brewing biodiesel in a shed in the backyard. There wasn't even time to get into that.
Wow.
And then, you know, just he reuses materials. He's got a garden made of 800 tires, and fiber optic cable is crushed up and turned into an artificial lake. He's really come up with these neat solutions and neat uses of, right. of stuff.
And unless you think he was some science-y geek, he was a firefighter for 20 years, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is the makings of a full-length feature, I think. But he's a firefighter in New York City and was injured in 9/11 and so ended up retiring. And actually, his firefighter buddies helped him build this. And he said, you know, the interesting thing about getting a kit for a geodesic dome is it's made of these triangles, right? So if any of the wood is slightly off, warped, you have a big problem once you get around to the other end of the circle.
Oh, yeah, I'm thinking about this.
So they have, like, tons of people sort of pulling things in line. It sounded like a really dramatic construction
you
process.
You need a lot of buddies to help out on this.
And a lot of strong firefighters, it sounds like.
And it's beautiful because you have all that inside space that's open to work with, right?
It's huge. It's like being in the – it's like living in the Omnimax. I mean, it's just this kind of really, really open space. And he uses it with – he's got a swing inside.
That's right. You could swing from side to side.
Which he does.
Yeah. You can see all of this in our video pick of the week. It's Flora Lichtman's got it up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. You can also download it on podcast it on iTunes, and it's up there on the left side. And this guy, you see him swinging on his rope, climbing up the roof.
It's worth watching. And also, I'm looking for other people who are living in sort of unconventional homes and doing things in a DIY green way, because Kevin really has figured out how to do this on his own.
Right.
So if you know of anybody, shoot me an email. I put my email address on our website. By the video.
And you asked a couple of weeks ago for mushroom pictures, right? And we got all kinds of mushrooms.
The mushroom pictures have flooded in. Check out the Facebook page. They're really beautiful, and we've got long sort of threads going on about what they are. I can't identify them, but our listeners are doing a good job.
All right, Flora Lichtman, our video pick of the week. That's about all the time we have for today. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Antaliata, Leshu Bayak. Sam Flato was our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director. Manoli Weatherall spinning the controls here today in New York. And if you missed any part of our program, go to iTunes, subscribe to our podcast, audio and video. And you want to see this video pick of the week, go to our website at sciencefriday.com, and you can send us, maybe you have some photos of your dome, still taking those mushroom pictures, and looking to post them up on our Facebook page. And you can join our growing Facebook community and our Twitter community. And we can all join each other on our homepage at sciencefriday.com. I'm Ira Flato in New York.
The fall television season is in high gear, and there seems to be a barrage of tight skirts, pantyhosed legs, and perfectly made-up faces making their way from the 1960s to the small screen today.
You see that table over there? That is natural selection at work, my friend. They don't know that they're a new breed of woman. They just had an impulse. Take flight.
That's a scene from ABC's new show. It's called Pan Am. It's about stewardesses in the 1960s. Nope, we didn't call them flight attendants back then. And while those stewardesses might have been a, quote, new breed of woman, there's a lot of 1960s going around these days. There's the Playboy Club on NBC and, of course, the show that started it all, AMC's hit Mad Men. So what is it with that era and the women who lived it that's captured our collective imagination? With me now is Stacey Wilson. She's a senior editor for Hollywood Reporter. She's joining me from NPR West in Southern California. Stacey, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what do you think? Why at this moment in 2011 are we fascinated, or at least TV producers are, with the 1960s?
I think the deal with the 60s is that it's, you know, one of the most glamorous, beautiful eras in our history. But I also think it was an era of the most change for women, and I think that offers some ripe scenarios for fictional storytelling and such.
ABC and NBC have both been marketing these shows by showcasing the female characters as really strong women, essentially working what they've got to get ahead in a man's world.
Right.
Here's a clip from the Playboy Club as one of the women is serving drinks to men at the club.
Everything's a buck and a half.
Everything?
If it's on the menu, it's a buck and a half. If it's not on the menu, it's not for sale. And I'm not a waitress. I'm Bunny Janie.
She's Bunny Janie. I mean, these shows are trying to paint these women as these strong characters, feminists even, but it's hard to buy when they're wearing bunny ears and corsets, no?
Right, and that show has gotten some flack, but I do think, yes, the women are hot, they're in tight clothes, but I do think it allows for interesting sort of evolution of character. When you start with a girl who's kind of confined to this costume, I'll be interested to see what they do with it. I think Pan Am actually has an edge it offers a bit more of a rich, more believable, I guess, tapestry of storylines later on.
Is there a part of the audience, of us, that actually relishes watching the sexism unfold in that era?
I think so, in a weird way. I think it's sort of train wreck history. We're sort of showing us the kind of the bad parts of who we used to be. I think Mad Men specifically, watching how the women are regarded in the office. The character of Peggy, she's actually had the benefit of evolving a great deal over the last 4 years. But there was a very pivotal moment in last season where she was talking to Don and he told her, you know, I don't have to thank you for your work. That's what the money's for. I think it really actually affords us great appreciation for how good things are now.
I want to play another clip from Pan Am. Here the character of Kate, who's one of the flight attendants, stewardesses, is bickering with her mother before her sister's wedding begins, and they're fighting about her lifestyle.
Do you know what we get to do?
You made it clear you don't care what I think of what you do. Go ahead, gallivant around the world if you like, but don't use your sister's special day.
Oh, this isn't Laura's special day, this is yours, because Laura hasn't made a decision for herself her whole life.
So they're clearly casting these women as some kind of pioneers.
Right.
Are they aiming for a feminine demographic with the show?
Certainly. I think they are really hoping that young women will tune in, you know, college age through 20s and 30s. You know, it's a great overtone. And, you know, the interesting thing about that show, it's a show created by a man and the pilot was directed by a man, which I find interesting because I think the overtone of the show is, wow, you know, look at yourself. Look at the options you have today. You can do whatever you want. And back then, the idea of being a flight attendant was rebellious, and it's absurd, but it's interesting. I think it makes you appreciate what we do have today in a lighthearted way without kind of beating you over the head with it.
A lot of the fall comedies out this season were actually created by women. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that, and why don't we see kind of longer dramas written by women?
It's interesting. I'm actually putting together a big package on showrunners, you know, the top 50 showrunners in the business, and there are very few women on the drama side. And I actually think about this a lot. I'm not sure why that is. I think women tend to use, and actually this applies to female stand-up comedians too, the humor tends to be very autobiographical. I think for whatever reason, women use these stories as catharsis. Jenny Bick specifically from The Big C said, if I can use my disease to make other people laugh, she's like, that's a great return for me.
What's significant about the roles that the men play in these shows?
They, for me, come across as kind of terribly unpleasant. But I also think they had so many expectations put on them. You know, married by 22, had to be providers. You do feel sort of empathy, but also kind of mild disgust.
There's also a lot of martinis happening.
A lot of martinis. So you can't blame everybody. You know, they weren't coherent most of the time. So we got to cut them a little slack.
That's Stacey Wilson, a senior editor for The Hollywood Reporter. She's been speaking with me from NPR West in California. Stacey, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
There's something missing this year from the fall scenery in the Northeast, especially in upstate New York. The state's normally a top pumpkin producer, but about a third of its pumpkin crop was destroyed in the recent tropical storms. Marie Cusick of member station WMHT in Albany takes us to one farm that was spared.
There's no shortage of pumpkins at the Black Horse Farm's roadside stand in Athens, New York, but some customers still aren't taking any chances.
I was worried about getting a pumpkin, and I figured I'll get mine here since I'm here.
1628.
Karen DeSico heard about pumpkin shortages, so she's happy to snag an extra large one here and happy to pay less than she would have at home in New York City.
Looks like a perfect pumpkin, $10, perfect. Gonna drive it home and not have to deal with it when I get back to Queens.
Although fall has just begun, demand for pumpkins has been steadier than usual, says Chelly Appa, who manages her family's farm stand.
I believe they're buying pumpkins earlier because I think they're afraid there won't be any.
Black Horse Farms is nestled in the Hudson River Valley along the northern edge of the Catskill Mountains. It was spared much of the flooding from tropical storms Irene and Lee that devastated other parts of the region. Appa says she's grateful.
Oh, we feel so blessed, and we feel so horrible for those poor people that have been so destroyed by the hurricane.
But her family business didn't escape the storms unscathed. Appa's sister, Lisa Burmaster, helps run their main farm down the road from the stand. Burmaster says they lost about a fifth of their pumpkin crop when a field they own 40 miles away was inundated.
We lost a field up in Schenectady that was along the Mohawk River, and those pumpkins are completely useless now. We've got a little bit of damage in the fields here, which everybody does, but for the most part, most of the pumpkins are good.
Burmaster says they were lucky to have a bumper crop down here in Athens. Workers are busy power washing the pumpkins and loading them into bins.
It takes a lot. There's about 20 guys that we have that harvest these pumpkins and bring them down, and they're just working all the time. They're great.
Most of their pumpkins are retailed to local grocery stores. Some go to New York City. Others are sent to national chains like Whole Foods. The rest are sold at their farm stands.
Yesterday, there was about 5,000 pumpkins that went out of here.
But with her losses and shortages elsewhere, Burmaster admits that people will pay about 20% more for her jack-o'-lanterns this Halloween. However, she says there's no need to get spooked about the supply.
Don't do a run on the pumpkins, but do buy your pumpkins. Don't be scared.
For NPR News, I'm Marie Cusick in Athens, New York.
This is NPR News.